Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm Fred Monroe, your host today. Central Coast Voices, as you know, is an environment that we've put together on the radio to really look at ways to bring you credible, valid information and insights from diverse members of our communities. Central Coast Voices wants to address how today's choices affect tomorrow's community and how we look at the long-term ramifications of change or lack thereof in our society. It's an interesting thing to look at on a regular basis, and we try and bring it to you when we can. For those of you who may be listening for the second time or the first time, I'm Fred Monroe, and I'm your host today, and I alternate weeks as hosting this program with Chris Kington Barker, and she'll be with you next week. The topic that we have on the table today the first time we've done a topic that has a title that really didn't come directly from us on the program. It's called You, Me, and Them, Experiencing Discrimination in America. And that is part of a large study that was put together by NPR on a national level and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Harvard T.H. Chan, School of Public Health. It's a unique study in that they looked at 3,400 respondents to the study and put together a report. Today we're going to deal with issues of being African American and how that fit into what some of the things the report came up with and the experience of some local members of the community. But the study also is looking at a very diverse map of people. And one of the things that's different about this study, you may have heard some things about it because it's been talked about now on Morning Edition for a couple of days, and it's going to extend for about a month and a half as an ongoing topic, is that this is not a study that was done with questions like, do you think there's discrimination in your community? Do you think that your community gets discriminated against? It really was, is your experience and your personal life experience such that you've experienced any of these kinds of issues of discrimination? Have you been discriminated against because there have been any kind of slurs towards you? Do you feel that's related to your race, your gender, your ethnic disposition, any of those kind of things? And it looked at a lot of things that go beyond what we would think of as normally issues of discrimination. Because today, while we're going to talk about African Americans and how they were looked at in this study, it's going to also, over time, look at Native Americans, Latinos, and white people. The concept of how white people perceive whether or not they've been discriminated against was part of this study also. So it's going to be a topic that we're going to carry on this program, and NPR is going to carry in their programming for the next couple of months. We would like to look at it as an overall experience and how people's experiences in society are affected by all of this. My guests today are Courtney Hale, and she is a founding member of RACE Matters, Race Matters, Slo County. Michael Latner, who's an associate professor of political science at Cal Poly. He's also the Kindle Voting Rights Fellow currently at the Union of Concerned Scientists in Washington, D.C. So for those of you who know, Michael's been on the program with us before, and he happens to be home to San Luis Obispo from his duties in that position with the Union of Concerned Scientists right now. And Renata Campbell, she is a Slo portrait photographer, San Luis Obispo portrait photographer, and a staff member emeritus of Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. Since this is radio and nobody gets pictures, and I believe this is important, I'm a white guy. Michael Latner's a white guy. The two women in their own room with us are black, and we are talking about issues about African American or black, depending on how you want to define it. I would not normally think that defining the gender of the people who are talking on the topic is important, but when there are two white people in the room talking about a topic for which they have never had personal experiences, I think it's important that we define that. So let's just jump in here and see where this goes. By the way, the phone number is, if you want to call in, is 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. If you want to call in and be part of this discussion, we would like you to join us, but please join us as early in the program as you can. When you call in the last 5 or 10 minutes of the program, we generally don't have time to fit you in. Courtney, I'm going to start with you because I want you to define what race is because, well, not define what race is, but define what RACE is because your organization is RACE Matters, San Luis Obispo.
Absolutely. It is an acronym. So the race, responsibility, action, compassion, and education. So that was a way to incorporate our core values into the title of our organization. But of course, by race, we're talking about race as we know it, mattering, and also matters of race and racial justice.
Okay. Because this study that was done was indeed focused on personal issues for people, and I will tell you one of the most disturbing parts of the study that I read is that, and I believe it was 33%, I'll go look at the study after somebody else talks on it a little bit, that the number of African Americans in the study who said they at some point in their life have decided to not call the police when they needed help with the police because of their ethnicity, they felt unsafe doing so. That's a very disturbing statistic. And those kind of issues, I think, are one of the things that comes to it the most. And one of the things that may get fit into this lot is, and people would probably be thinking, I'm sure somebody listening right now is thinking, oh, that might apply in LA, it might apply in St. Louis, a number of other places it may apply, but it would never apply in San Luis Obispo. So does that kind of information ring true to you?
I'm glad you brought that up. So living in San Luis Obispo, we are sheltered in that we're not surrounded by any major cities. But and I was thinking about this on the way over here. We're not, many of us moved from other places, African Americans and not. We travel to other places. We have family everywhere. So things like police statistics and issues that happen nationally affect us. And prior instances with discrimination, even if they're in another area, once you come back here, that still affects you and your psyche and can lead to a distrust of certain institutions. And so for that reason, it's not a surprise that 33% believe that way. And I think it does affect African Americans living here, whether or not they personally have experienced issues with law enforcement here in San Luis Obispo or this area. Still, the national headlines or things that have happened to them in other places or to family members, it still is in, you know, folks' minds, and that can lead to a distrust, even locally.
And I agree. I'm originally from Los Angeles, and there was a situation years ago when my father was robbed right in our garage. And it took the police 4 hours to get there. And so when you, as a kid, seeing that, thinking, okay, it took 4 hours for them to come to the house just to take a statement and nothing really transpired after that, to moving up here, that distrust definitely was there. And so, you know, I felt, why should I bother if anything should happen to me in San Luis Obispo? But I was also very concerned about that. So I've reaped some of the repercussions of what has happened nationally.
Yeah. Renata, one of the things that you had said in some of the notes that you sent us to put together some information for the program is that the reference to you grew up in South Central Los Angeles and you made it out of South Central Los Angeles. So why would you see anything as having any kind of racism in your life? You're on the cool Central Coast. This isn't East LA anymore. Doggone it. What's the big deal?
I have to say, living in South Central LA, it was extremely diverse. And coming here, the situations that I have faced as an African American woman in a biracial family has really skewed some of the what I felt was very diverse living in Los Angeles. So, a situation, for example, when we moved here, I had two young kids, and I went into a supermarket and the cashier said, "Do you have WIC?" I had never heard of WIC before. And so I said, "Oh, what's WIC?" And she said, "Oh, never mind, never mind." And I had, you know, I got home, looked it up, and I thought, "Oh, okay, this is the way San Luis Obispo people think of an African American woman with two children, the assumption that I must be on WIC."
I don't want this to sound for a second at all as if I'm defending the position of the person who asked you that question. But I suspect there's a possibility in their mind that they thought they were being extra courteous to you so you didn't have to actually tell them you had it. And I'm wondering, and I bring that up now, and I'll bring it up and we'll get rid of it real quick. Mm-hmm. I think oftentimes among the Anglo population, there's a desire to be extra accommodating to people of any ethnic background that's other than their own. And they see that as, oh, I'm putting my arm around you and helping you out a little bit. And I think a lot of people, it never registers for them how much, my words, not anybody else's, that is really talking down to someone. And that's something that becomes, but I've heard that the defense of, oh, I was just trying to be accommodating, or I was just trying to be understanding, and in the process, I'm being incredibly offensive. How do you respond? Well, you may have responded to that by just letting it go. Mm-hmm. I think I probably would have responded it if I had been you, probably far curter than that. But
right.
What kind of educational process do you bring to the table, or can you bring to the table, when those kind of things happen?
Well, it's interesting. Working at Cal Poly for many years and being in the community for many years now, I have taken on that educational component. So if people have questions that they honestly don't know and come with pure heart, I will answer them. But if people come, you know, and they are not, they're just asking to be silly or with their friends and things like that, then I won't answer them. But for this particular woman, I honestly did not even know what that meant. And I would rather someone be courteous and say something in a positive or wealthier situation than thinking that I was on WIC, you know? So asking me if I have an American Express Black card. Yeah, you know.
I can't afford one of those, but thank you. Okay. Yeah. I want to get back to that in a moment. I want to remind folks also that this is a discussion that they're welcome to be part of if they want. The phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. This is part of an ongoing series we're doing in conjunction with a study from National Public Radio and Harvard University on experiencing discrimination in America. And we're going to look at a lot of it over the coming weeks. I'll mention to you that Chris Kington Barker's program next week will be on the topic related to the Latino community, but on the same study. And we'll get into that in a little bit. Michael, I want to bring you into the discussion because there's one thing when we one of the questions that we send out to everybody is, what are there any particular misconceptions you see as to how people see a given topic? And one of your feedbacks, because obviously you're the political science guy and you always talk politics even more than I do, which is hard to do, is that, gee, didn't Barack Obama getting elected president end racism in North America because we indeed elected a black president? So all bets are off on anybody feeling racist anymore.
Yeah, that's a.
I want to say I don't believe that, but that's right. What's said. Okay.
Sure. No. Well, and I think that there is a widespread perception that because we've had an African American president, that cultural norms have changed with regard to whites' perceptions of blacks, so much so that you know this is an achievement, and there's no question about it. It is a major achievement. There's no question about it that cultural norms have changed significantly. When you look at going back to the 50s and 60s prior to the civil rights movement, the whites' attitudes towards interracial marriage, whites' attitudes towards economic equality, right? I mean, there are changes, but what I think is one of the most valuable things that comes out of this survey is the breadth of how racism works and how it is experienced by folks of all races. This survey does a fantastic job of delving into economic racism, political racism and discrimination, and structures of authority in particular. So one of the things that I was most struck by in the survey was that of all the forms of discrimination that people experience and people that folks say where they live, people of their race have this experience. You look at just the raw percentages, right? I mean, the single largest category is interacting with police among African Americans, and this is, you know, looking at the other groups, which you'll get into as the survey comes out. But these are the areas where there are the starkest differences between whites and African Americans and Latinos are with authority structures. So interactions with police, trying to rent or buy housing, and political participation. And one of the things that I would like to discuss that I think is something that's not well understood, right? When you go back to the question of, well, we've had Barack Obama as president now, that the very presumption that we might, you know, be over this huge hump of discrimination and racism in the country, that presumes that racism is fundamentally an individual act, that it is, that racism has to have intent, and that it's individuals that are discriminating against one another. And one of the things that we see from this survey is that indeed people understand and experience institutional racism. That is a racism that exists because of the way that social institutions are designed, which may or may not have intent behind it. And that's something that I think is really worth talking about, and something that we need to have a broader national discussion about, because it can clarify this sort of naive assumption that because there are fewer people that are openly racist, that we're not a racist country.
Courtney, you're shaking your
yes,
head.
Yes, I am. Okay. Yeah, I'd love to piggyback off of that.
Go ahead, jump
so,
in.
So part of the study that stuck out to me, again, about the institutional racism versus individuals who are racist. It looks like 49% of African Americans thought that discrimination is based on the prejudice of individual people. 25% believe discrimination is based on laws and government policies. And then 25% thought both equally. So I would be in the both equally category. Mm-hmm. But a larger point I want to make is when we talk about institutions and power, these individual racists who are committing these acts have jobs. Some of them might be in these positions in these institutions. And so we can see how it all ties together.
Yeah. Because just for some of them have been fired
right.
from their jobs based upon being more public recently.
Right.
But we didn't hear much about that kind of thing until the last three or four months.
Right. The Tiki Torch
yeah.
bros or whatever.
Yeah.
right. They showed their faces publicly. They took off their hoods. And many were outed on social media. And it's just interesting that they were so bold to step out in the public in the first place, and so comfortable thinking maybe they were prepared to lose their jobs.
That they're empowered, they feel empowered to do so
right.
in this time.
Right.
So there are more people who seem empowered based upon the last election.
Right.
Let's just leave it as based on the
yes,
last election.
Yes. Okay. And do those people who were out there have some cousins who aren't quite, they didn't go to the Tiki Torch rally because they're in law school and maybe they're going to be a judge one day, but they're still on that spectrum mm-hmm. of racism, maybe not so overt to show up that day and show their face. But that's what I think about often, is that there's that spectrum of covert to overt racism. And it's more than just the men in the tiki torches.
Well, and I would just add that I think that something that many white Americans, frankly, have very little understanding of is what we mean by institutional racism, that when we're not talking about individuals, right? We're not, even if we got rid of all those folks, right? That doesn't mean that there still wouldn't be racist laws and policies that are treating people differently, right? And so when we look at institutional racism in something like education, right, where children of color are geographically more concentrated in areas that have that struggle with resources to provide basic education, right? Those are, we can think of the tax structure in that sense as having a racist consequence. Or in the area where I do research, when we look at election laws, you know, we can distinguish between what we might think of as sort of old-timey racism, right? So literacy tests, poll taxes, the white primary, right? All these mechanisms that functioned in the South to specifically disenfranchise African Americans. But what we understand less, I think, are that there are laws that have the exact same effect that are not specifically or overtly racist. And so when we look at partisan gerrymandering, for example, where the impetus is partisan disempowerment, but in fact you're still packing districts with 85-90% African Americans, and so you're diluting the value of their vote in exactly the same way that those older laws functioned. When we look at purging people off of voter registration lists, those types of laws disproportionately affect people that move more often, people that are lower income, and so they have a disproportionate effect on specific populations, even though, you know, there may not be an old racist judge that's actually running the program. These laws have racist consequences.
The old racist judge is a little easier to spot.
Precisely.
Right. Okay, right. These are not. Well, let's get back to that. I've kept Sandra and Arroyo Grande. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air now.
Hi.
Hi.
You know what? This is a topic that really pisses me off to no end. Because I am Hispanic. I'm an immigrant from El Salvador. I came to this country with great education from El Salvador and no English. And I went to nursing school, and this country gave me the opportunity to do whatever I wanted to do. And I'm so sick and tired of people blaming their failures on racism. Get over it. You know what? Racism today exists because of minorities, because people feel that. Let's just say that a white person looks at me. Why should I assume that person is looking at me because I'm Hispanic? You know what? Maybe they like my hair. Maybe they like my shoes. What the hell? But in my experience, when I worked in Los Angeles, I experienced more discrimination from other minorities than from white people. And we also have a responsibility to fight racism with love and care. I am a registered nurse, and the one experience I had with a patient who was, like, blatantly racist, that he said he didn't like, you know, the N-words. And I came in, and he was just obnoxious, and he asked me if I was the maid. I explained to him that I wasn't. And you know what I decided to do? I decided to kill him with kindness and show him a different way. By the end of my shift, the man apologized to me for being a jerk.
Okay.
So I... saying, you know what, let's just look at racism from our own angle. Let's just not, we need to stop it. Stop it. You know what, my children, when I signed them up for school, they want to know the race. What the hell? Stop asking for race. How about just the human race?
Okay.
That's
Thanks.
All I have to say.
Okay.
I'm really passionate about this.
Okay, we can tell. Thanks, Sandra. I guess I'll try and leave it alone, but I won't leave it alone. Do you oftentimes hear people from minorities and other black people who say, oh, just get over it? Because I would, if I were to put it just one word on Sandra's conversation, it is just get over it.
Right, right. I haven't heard that from a ton of fellow black folks, but I have heard from some who feel, you know, actually, I don't really experience racism. I just do my thing. I've heard that attitude. I haven't interacted with someone of that particular opinion that we just heard. But it's true, not all people of color have the same experiences. She's speaking from her experience. I personally think anti-black racism, it's how our country began. There's still an open wound. Avoiding it and not talking about it, I don't think works. And that is my opinion. I think you name it for what it is. It's racism. We're talking today about anti-black racism. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a report in which African Americans described experiences they had.
Mm-hmm.
And I am a firm believer that you believe someone when they talk about their discrimination. You don't push it aside or minimize it. And that's my position.
Renata, I want to make the comparison again of living here versus living in L.A. You and I both grew up in L.A., in different neighborhoods of L.A., but grew up in L.A. and moved to here. On a regular basis, the study saying things like a significant portion of black people are more frightened to call law enforcement when they need them because of their ethnicity. Have you experienced anything like that in your life?
In Los Angeles or San Luis Obispo?
Oh, actually, I'd like to hear about both. Well, the experience in L.A., which it took 4 hours to get a response, is at least you called or somebody called, but yeah.
Right. In Los Angeles, I think living in the neighborhood where I did, and this is in my formative years, so this was as a child, then I did go to college and moved away. It's just what it was. I mean, you know, everyone knew. I mean, you know, there was a lot of gang violence in my neighborhood as well. So you just, it's really unfortunate that you knew that no one was going to come and assist you unless there was a death or, you know, someone was critically injured. Here in San Luis Obispo, even though I came here kicking and screaming, I did not want to move here at all. My husband wanted to move here, and I just was the good, you know, the good wife who followed him. I did not find that insofar as the police. Now, some of the students that I had dealt with at Cal Poly did have a lot of issues with police. So there are a lot of stories that way. I have found that you know, the police here, if you call within 2 minutes, they're here. And so that to me was a shocker. you know, going from 4 hours to 2 minutes, it's like, whoa, wait a minute, what happened here? I've grown to love San Luis Obispo. Let me preface that. But it was tough. And so, you know, sometimes you miss what's going on in L.A. insofar as being out of the loop. You really, because we are in this bubble, we don't hear that much of what's going on in our towns unless our family are telling us. So, but needless to say, in San Luis Obispo, I just have not found that issue insofar as police. Now, I have been pulled over. Twice for speeding. I admit that. and once I got a ticket, and once I did not. So that I found really interesting on why I got a ticket at this time and why I didn't in this other situation. And the police officer was just talking to me. And then all of a sudden, I said, you know, I really need to go. Do you need my driver's license and registration? And he's like, what, do you want a ticket? And I said, no. And he said, okay, then drive on past. And so I drove away. So I just don't quite understand San Luis Obispo still.
Yeah, my observation I must share with you, that probably has more to do with as this study does, that's an individual to individual issue. And I think that becomes a factor we look at with regard to racial issues generally. Michael, jump on it.
Yeah, well, I would just, for some context, I think that we need to respect and acknowledge the caller's experience and every individual's experience, and at the same time, put it into context, right? So 80% of Latinos disagree with the idea that there is not discrimination against Latino people in America today, right? I mean, that is something. I mean, one of the most amazing things from the study is that everyone feels discriminated against, right? Even a majority of whites. Yep. And so I think that it's important to acknowledge that, but at the same time see that, you know, this is the experience when we look at representational samples, right? This is how people experience their own lives. And, you know, the idea that we need to get over it, well, how does one get over the fact that people of color not only experience, but aggregate data has demonstrated that they're treated differently by police than white people are, right? How do you get over that? How do you get over the fact that Hispanic Americans in Texas, that there's racial gerrymandering that goes on there that splits those populations up and dilutes the value of their votes? How does one get over that? This is not an individual issue that one gets over. It's structural.
The issue I think we're dealing with in a lot of cases is how visible it is. I mean, we now refer to them as the torch group to some extent, the Tiki torch group, which maybe is an easy way to put together the neo-Nazis, the KKK, and just the angry white guy with a pickup truck and a Confederate flag. So we now have a subgroup we can just call them. So if you'll indulge me for today, they're the Tiki torch guys, and we'll leave it at that.
I think the Tiki torch manufacturers would be really insulted by that.
I don't know. They might have gotten a lot of extra business. There's a group of people who has been, I mean, this study was done last winter, okay? It takes a long time to put study results together and such, but it's all taken place since the last election, but we've seen more visibility and more audibility, if you will, of things going on. I don't believe we have more racism now than we had 3 years ago. But my hunch is we have more people who are willing to openly talk about their own racism than we did 3 years ago. Have any of you seen that?
Talk about their own racism, meaning white folks examine, like,
oh yeah, I guess, yeah, I'm this badass guy with a Confederate flag on the back
overt,
of my truck.
Yes,
and
yes.
Doggone it, it doesn't matter because the guy I voted for is president now, so I'm home free.
Right. We're certainly seeing more overt displays, and with social media and things going viral at any given point, after Charlottesville, my feed was like all Nazis, and it's like, oh my gosh, what's going on? So I think the spreading of information as it becomes more prolific, and also the overt displays, and also the rise in, some people say, social justice warriors or folks who aren't afraid to speak out against that, especially with our young folks, our young communities, and again with social media and popular culture as well. It's more of a topic, I believe, racism, oppression, resistance, the whole spectrum of sort of jargon and those topics, I find that are more talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The part of what I think ties into it is that the Black Lives Matter movement, okay, has gotten a backlash of don't all lives matter, okay? Well, if we're talking about discrimination in a given aspect of the community, then we're saying, hey, those who are discriminated against matter and they're not being paid attention to. But I'm one of the white guys in the room saying I really still don't understand why saying something like Black Lives Matter offends people who want to turn it around and say, well, don't all lives matter? I don't know how we balance that out.
I think it's a question that I've answered a lot. Black Lives Matter never meant that all lives don't matter.
Yeah.
And it's just the fact that it had to ever be said, I think, is very telling.
Oh, gee, but isn't being pro-black somehow being anti-white?
No. and that's interesting,
okay,
because I think sometimes that's
a tough question for me to even ask, because I realize it's, in my mind, it's an absurd question.
Yeah, I know.
But it's a question we have to ask. Okay,
yes,
all right, thank you. Okay.
Of course. pro-black is not anti-white, and it's interesting, in my opinion, I've seen it said elsewhere, there are some white folks who might think that because pro-white or white supremacy in its overt form is anti-people of color. And so I guess if that's your viewpoint and you see Black Lives Matter and pro-black, black power, black is beautiful, it's like, well, what about everyone else? Or you see it flipped and you think that your ideology, in which people of color, you're anti-people of color if you're pro-white, applies in the opposite way. That's the only way I can think of it.
A balancing act that's tough to balance, but it's, yeah,
right,
difficult. We have a number of callers. Let me go ahead and I've kept some of them waiting. Sorry. Garland in Atascadero. You're on the air. Thank you. Thanks for your patience.
How are you doing? A couple of points. First of all, it's an interesting discussion because I think it's a very timely discussion. But I'm going to give you an example. I live in Atascadero. Originally, I moved up here in the 90s, and I moved to Cambria. And just a good example of how things happen. I worked every morning. I was an institutional broker. And I went to work at 4 o'clock in the morning, and by noon I was done. I went to the post office, and I would pick up my check. And from there, I would go over to Camosi's, and I would drink a beer and shoot some snooker, which I learned. And thankfully, Patty, which unfortunately she's dead now, but she would always tell me what the town was saying, because I was the only black person that was in Cambria at the time. And they assumed I was a drug dealer because nobody ever saw me going to work. They assumed that I had to be doing something illegal no matter what. And anyway, Patty was the only person that knew what I really did for a living. So when she found out I was an institutional broker, and the irony of it is that during that time, the big new piece of equipment was a fax machine. And a fax machine allowed me to move up here from Dana Point in Orange County to Cambria. Well, when the community found out I had a fax machine, because nobody had a fax machine, everybody starts now calling me, can you fax this for me? Can you fax that for me? And that was the only way that it really changed the image, because initially it was an assumption. You got to be doing drugs because we don't see you working. We don't see you doing anything else. But all we see you is going to the bank and depositing a check. And I think that's where one of the problems comes from in this society is the assumption. We are too easy to judge a person by the book of its color than who that person really is. And I just wanted to share that story because it is totally different. Until you take the time to get to know the person who it is, you really find out who they are. And yes, I think prejudice is just as prevalent today as it was back in the 60s. I was born in 1949, so I'm 68. I've been through it. I've gone from, you know, sitting at the top of the, in the balcony in the theaters. I've drank from the color water fountain. I've sat on the back of the bus. I've done all those things, okay? But, you know, the thing of it is that until we as a society began to accept we are all human beings and we are all equal, we are always going to have this problem. And unfortunately, with the presidency that we have right now and what's been created and the turmoil that's there, it has allowed the people that have suppressed their feelings all these years finally to feel free. Oh, now I can really express who I am and how I feel.
Okay. Very good point, Garland. Thank you very much. It's a very a tremendously good synopsis of the situation and how we need to look at things differently. I appreciate the call. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Let's go to Anthony in Santa Barbara. Anthony, are you there? Thanks for your patience.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're doing good today.
Good. This is a great topic, I think, people to get some stuff off their chest. My purpose for calling is that I'm being stalked every day in this community. Literally stalked. They wait for me to come out. They follow me. They text about me. When I say they, I'm talking about white people in this community. I'm not on probation. I'm not on parole or nothing. But these people won't leave me alone. And we know that this country is built on racism. It'll never go anywhere. Michael Eric Dyson wrote a book called Tears We Cannot Stop. And this book is so profound. He wrote it, the way he wrote it, is really speaking about the modern day racism. The modern day also racism is that 85% of African American men are populating prisons. The system is designed against us. It's not for us. When I say us, I'm talking about African American men that are struggling and trying to get their lives in order. But when you got other obstacles with people like what I'm going through, with people constantly stalking me, I've been to the police department, told them, they even turned around and stalked me.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. I thank you very much for the call. We probably haven't talked about this. I suspect the average black man feels differently than the average white man. And I feel the average black man feels differently than the average black woman. Because we live in a society where men, most of the bullies are men. Most of the domestic violence comes about from men. So I'm wondering if, have you witnessed, I mean, obviously there are no black men in the room for this discussion today, but do you see that black women maybe are not as seen as threatening as black men on a daily basis?
I think gender definitely interacts with and complicates racism, and one of the areas is the fear of black men. And I think it's interesting, Anthony said stalking, and if you remember Trayvon Martin, was followed and essentially stalked.
Yeah.
I definitely think there's a different experience. I've talked to black men who've grown up here and who've talked about growing up, being stopped by the police a lot. I have not been personally. Like, I was speeding once and I did get pulled over, and I was speeding. I got the ticket and I own that. But I do think it's a different experience as a man and moving through your life and through society with people fearing you, everyday people, and also law enforcement. Okay.
Michael, I want to turn to you about issues of, because voting rights is an area of specialty with you. The Voting Rights Act has been, polished down as a, I can't think of a better word. I can say some things that I probably shouldn't say about it.
Gutted is another word.
Okay, gutted. Gutted's a good word. Okay, it's been gutted. Because there, well, where I'm going with this is there's a tremendous amount of legislative and judicial commentary about the fact that the things that the Voting Rights Act was supposed to accommodate has all been fixed now.
Sure. Chief Justice Roberts, in his own words, in writing the opinion that essentially took the teeth out of the Voting Rights Act, which was Section 4. This is the triggering aspects that required states that were under the VRA, under what's known as the preclearance section. That means that they had a history of discrimination. So most of the Confederate states, a number of counties, even in counties in California. But the process used to be that before they changed any of their election laws, they had to go to the courts, or they had to go to the Department of Justice and get permission to change their laws. And in gutting that section of the Voting Rights Act, the majority opinion of the Supreme Court was that this is no longer the South of the 1960s or even 1970s, when most of that data was compiled, and it certainly was stale data in Section 4, and that's an important critique. But certainly, I think that if for Justice Roberts just to look around today and look at the consequences of the Trump presidency and this discussion that we're having, no, it's not the 60s, but racism is not just pervasive in terms of the norms that we're governed by, but specifically in the law. And what we're seeing, in fact, is that as soon as that decision was made, we saw Alabama, we saw Georgia, North Carolina, a number of states begin to initiate stricter voter registration lists. They began to change the laws on eligibility, and we are, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that what we're seeing in American electoral litigation right now is a new form of Jim Crow. These are new laws that are having the exact same effect as those old laws has had under a different guise. And it goes through the entire court system. I was just reading yesterday a new study from Loyola Law School by Carlos Berdejo that looked at plea bargaining. Plea bargaining is a major use that the prosecutors use to move things through the crowded court system. And his study of 30,000 cases just in Wisconsin showed that that the taking account all the other factors that black people suffered from more harsh plea bargains. And when comparing blacks with whites, both of whom had no criminal history, blacks were more likely to be forced to take a plea bargain. And this is and their sentences were worse. And so this is the consequences that then ripple down, because you've got one in four black men in the South who have a criminal record and who are ineligible to vote. They are disempowered.
Can I ask a question? Why are people doing this? It's just not right. Why are they changing it so that people, certain people, have harsher sentences? You know the old laws. Those laws were very, very different. Why are they changing it to the more negative?
Well, so the sentencing inequalities, I think, are very telling, and get back to this question of individual versus institutional racism, because on the one hand, yes, you could just have racist judges. But on the other hand, there's a lot of experimental psychology and a lot of other data that suggests that rather than intentional racism, there's a more implicit racism that's going on, and that that this may not even be something that is intentional by the individuals, that they're not even recognizing the way that they're treating individuals unequally, right, as judges or as potential employers. The probability of being called back for a job interview, if you have a black-sounding last name, it's much lower than it is if your name is Smith or something that doesn't.
There was recently an issue with Airbnb,
right,
excluding people based upon their ethnicity, that we think would, they're just going to go rent an apartment someplace for the weekend. It's a topic that I think one of the things we haven't talked about that has kind of slapped me in the face personally looking at some of this in the last few weeks is we're very alarmed about the epidemic with the deaths and overdoses for opioids.
Mm-hmm.
We did not spend nearly as much effort and nearly as much alarm and have as much alarm when we were talking about people dying from crack cocaine or what it was doing to communities and societies. That was predominantly a minority issue. Okay, the opioids is an issue in Nebraska, Ohio,
West Virginia,
Is that a topic that that the black community has noticed?
I've definitely noticed it. And just in the language, the opioid crisis, the people who are struggling with it are seen as victims sort of the opioids and of the crisis, whereas with crack, it's that these bad people are doing it. And it's very noticeable if you watch the media and have watched media for a while and you notice those differences. And it's those everyday things, those everyday how racism is perpetuated culturally and also through pop culture and media, just the ways and the language that's used. But I haven't looked specifically into perceptions of the opioid issue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Look just at the president's announcement today, right? I mean, I think you can contrast this with what went on in the 80s. Crack was an epidemic, right? And it was an epidemic that was to be dealt with through law enforcement. Mm-hmm. opioids are a public health emergency, right? So we are now talking about health policy. It's a public health issue about the danger of addiction, right? It's not being dealt with through law enforcement. And I think so when you distinguish that type of policy approach, that highlights the difference with which we're treating the populations that are suffering from these, which are both health problems.
I'm a liberal white guy, and I would consider that to be a racist issue. And we don't have enough time to cover it today, mm-hmm. but I think that's part of probably what we're looking at. Mm-hmm. And maybe as we look at some things from this study and other populations also, as the couple of months goes on, we can look at that also. I wish we had 3 hours. We don't. As most of our listeners know, I try and get out of the way to give my guests at least a couple of minutes to say what they think it needs to be said that maybe hasn't been covered. Renata, we get to start with you.
Oh, great. Okay, I'm going to yield a lot of my time to the other two speakers, but this was a really great project that I encourage all of you to. I don't know if they're going to be given a URL to review this, and all of them, actually. I'd be interested in reading all of the findings. Yeah. But this is not something that we can just get over. It's something that really needs to be discussed throughout all of society, not just in universities, but amongst friends, and to try and come with a loving component to it, and not just getting angry. There are times I know I get really angry too, but if you come from a giving heart, asking questions and really not knowing and really wanting to know the answers and to be able to accept those answers, then I think that that's really important. But this is a discussion that's going to continue for many years.
And I think it is one that has to continue for many years. One of the things, Renata, that you brought up was that sometimes non-minorities believe if they just go to a one-hour cultural diversity workshop somewhere, everything is just fine and they've got it all figured out.
Yes, in my time at Cal Poly, a lot of people just thought, okay, I've done an hour. I know everything now, so I'm an expert. No, you're not. We must all continue to, you know, do our research, listen to credible authors, credible research institutions to get your information. And of course, you can listen to your friends, but who are very knowledgeable about this. But continue to research and don't just go by some of the things that you see on Facebook, since we now know that that can all be from other countries and, you know, other places that may not have our best interests at heart.
Okay. Thank you. Michael.
That's a great point. This is the beginning of a really important conversation that we've started to have, and certainly, you know, looking at our last two presidents, Barack Obama and now Donald Trump, we are going to have this conversation, I think, one way or another. And so I think that NPR and Robert Wood Johnson and Harvard are doing a great service to provide this rich data set that speaks to the experiences of many races and many other groups about their own experience of discrimination. And this is going to be a necessary conversation if we are going to get to the point where we can agree on policies that are going to help improve the quality of life for all Americans and get us ever closer to that idea of a more perfect union. It is certainly an uphill battle, and it's something that's going to take time and take energy, but this is our responsibility.
That may be why you picked the profession you're into. Courtney.
I echo both those statements. I wanted to respond really quickly to the first caller. I just wanted to add on just to make the point that when we're comparing groups of color, people of color, while there certainly are black immigrants, African immigrants, Caribbean immigrants, when we're talking about pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps and no excuses, and that's awesome, good for you, but we're also talking about African Americans who are the descendants of slaves who were brought against their will, families split up, not allowed to read or write. We're comparing that to immigrant groups can be a faulty comparison. So it's just something to keep in mind when we're comparing experiences of groups of color. And want to talk a bit about our group Race Matters. We're on Facebook, Race Matters. Race is capitalized. We're on Instagram now, Race Matters Slow. Couple of neat programs. One program is a parent and youth education group. So for parents of color, parents with kids of color, and also parents who want to raise racially conscious and socially conscious children, you can reach us at race.matters.slow@gmail.com if you're interested in that group. We really want to focus on the youth with our programming. That's what we're moving into, and I think that's a really positive thing. We also have Slow Welcomes decals. So we wanted to create a welcoming. A gentleman named Duskin Hobbs, a local teacher, contacted us when we were seeing an increase in hate crimes after the most recent election, and wanted San Luis Obispo, especially as a largely homogenous community, to be welcoming to all marginalized groups. And at Race Matters, we stand with all marginalized groups. So we created decals that are available at Len Collective, and that's a boutique in downtown SLO, 722 Marsh. And all the proceeds do come back to Race Matters.
Okay. I thank you all for being here today. And again, this is a topic we could probably talk on for a lot more hours. I don't want you or our listeners to ever feel like we didn't cover enough material. We just have a finite period of time to do it. And that's why we're here. As Central Coast Voices, we're trying to lend a local voice to what it was a rather extensive national study, a tremendous piece of work. I'll remind you all that it was a study that really focused on what people experienced personally, not what they perceived their community to experience. And that is what was helpful to read about. The full report is not available yet. They're putting it out in sections, but it's available on npr.org, and it'll also be tied to other topics and other programs on KCBX and in other venues with regard to how it's seen, because it's a rather extensive report. Next week, Chris Kington Barker will be joining this conversation, and she'll be shifting the discussion to perspective of the Latino community. And I want to remind you again that this is a study that was contracted for by NPR as part of an NPR project, along with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, to look at these issues on a national level. And we want to strive to further help people understand how they fit into the local community. I personally want to suggest to you that probably one of the best things you can do is not be afraid to ask people who are different than you how they feel about being different in this community, because very few people, I think, if you ask them with a kind heart about what you want to know about, won't talk about it. And I think those of us who are the Anglo community oftentimes feel like bringing it up and broaching it is somehow not an acceptable topic. So that's one reason why I think this program is important, but I would encourage people to talk to each other. As I've told you before, this is a production of Action for Healthy Communities, and it's a project of the Community Foundation and KCBX Public Radio. You can reach us at voices@kcbx.org or 543-2323. Thank you today to my guests, Courtney Hale, Michael Latner, and Renata Campbell. I appreciate it. Thank you very much for being with us. Thank you. This has been Central Coast Voices.